How will you disrupt yourself?
On today's show,
there also are political choices that we can make as a society to value this work that is incredibly important better and value it monetarily, not just sort of by clapping for care workers or whatever it is, but actually really to say, you know, or not like billboards that say thank you, essential workers, but like a raise for essential workers.
Welcome back to the Disrupt Yourself podcast, where we provide strategies and advice on how to climb the S-curve of learning in your professional and personal life. Stepping back from who you are into who you want to be. I'm Whitney Johnson. Before we get into this week's conversation, I wanted to share some feedback from you, our listeners. This comes from Beth, and it's particularly relevant to this week's episode. You'll hear why in just a moment. Hi, Whitney. I doubt I'm your typical listener, as I have been a stay-at-home mom of 5 kids for 30 years. Which has included living in a variety of places in the United States, plus overseas, while my husband was in the military, and I was dealing with multiple medical challenges of my youngest. I recently disrupted my life and am still in the launch part of my S-curve. Prior to COVID, I applied to grad school and started attending part-time in the middle of the pandemic in September 2020. I am learning constantly and feel very much out of my comfort zone. Your podcast helps me keep in perspective where I am on the curve and gives me hope that I will someday figure out what I'm doing and arrive at the sweet spot. I've recently been pondering more deeply, what is my purpose? So your delightful interview with Tanya Dalton, episode 241, inspired me to write it down. My purpose is to be a compassionate, brave, intentional, and joyful peacemaker who works to strengthen individuals and families. Thanks for sharing your knowledge and insights with the world. Sincerely, Beth. Thank you so much for this wonderful email, Beth. It's inspiring to me on so many levels, but also in part because our society doesn't always recognize raising children, which is very hard and very important, as work or a career. We value it, but not enough to pay for it in the traditional sense. We don't think of it as an S-curve of learning. We just think of it as life. What if we could value work differently? What would the world look like if we stopped treating work itself as our purpose, but as a means to enjoy a more important purpose? Family, relationships, hopes, dreams, and love. That's just the starting point of Sarah Jaffe's book, Work Won't Love You Back. Sarah is a journalist who covers labor issues and social movements, and she's observed a major shift in the way we view our jobs. Not only are stress and burnout at an all-time high, as we discussed at length in our popular episode 238 with Jennifer Moss, but our jobs have become our identity. Work is our main source of value, and companies purport to be a family. After all, we spend 50 hours a week with our colleagues. Sarah argues that this family model for business is toxic because at the end of the day, most employment is transactional and not rooted in personal well-being. She profiles teachers, interns, programmers, and professional athletes to identify which kind of work is valued and which is not. And as the Great Resignation has hinted, many people want out. But where are they going? And what does work-life balance, what does work-life fit look like from here? Sarah and I are both really fascinated with this question, but are coming at it from totally different perspectives. I think you'll really enjoy where our minds meet in the middle. So Sarah, tell us about a crucible experience in your life, something that made you who you are.
Oh my goodness, there are so many. I have just moved back to New Orleans, and so I feel like that's going to be the stories that I want to tell. I went to school here just about 1998 to 2002. So I moved away 20 years ago and have just returned to this place that really made me who I am in all of these strange ways that I'm just sort of realizing. And I think, interestingly, I'm going to talk about the decision to move away from New Orleans, which in 2002, you know, having finished college and having gotten an English degree, which is really, you know, hot on the job market, especially in 2002 when we were in the post 9/11 recession, I moved away from New Orleans thinking, well, if I stay here, I'm just going to keep working in the restaurant that I'm working in and keep trying to write a novel. And I'm never going to get like a real career and a real job and a real whatever. And I'll just be here in 20 years still trying to write a novel. It was a terrible decision. It was an awful decision to move away from New Orleans. This is why I've moved back. But particularly because like throwing myself into this job market with no idea, I think this is probably true for a lot of people, but especially in the late 90s, the story was just go to college and you will get a job and you will figure it all out later. Do what you love, right? And you will, all the rest of it will sort itself out. And by the early 2000s, that was no longer at all the story. And so what I ended up doing in Denver was the same thing I had been doing in New Orleans, which is waiting tables and paying a lot more in rent. And then on the side, doing my side hustle of trying to be a journalist, which meant writing for free or very, very little money for whatever online publications would take me. And obviously, looking back on that story, I think about like all of the ways that that shaped this book that I wrote and also this person that I am that now at age 40 is, you know, 41, moved back to New Orleans. And because it's a city that I was joking that a lot of people move to avoid getting a real job, but I think that that's true. Like it's a city that runs on the service industry and music and the arts and is also falling apart in all of these really obvious ways that the rest of the U.S. is also falling apart. But New Orleans is just more obvious. It's a lot more on the surface because everybody's aware sort of post-Katrina that New Orleans is living on borrowed time. So that's not a terribly coherent story, but it is something that I'm thinking about a lot sort of 20 years later as a cycle in my life.
As you've moved back, what is something that you've discovered about yourself that you've said, oh, New Orleans shaped me?
One of the most important things is this understanding that like my career is not the most important thing in my life. And again, this all sounds like terribly, terribly on brand, and I'm sorry, I swear. But it is really true that ultimately I was living in New York and I had a good career, and I still do. And I was not happy going to schmoozy media parties and having everything in my life be around what I did for a living. And so it's nice to be somewhere where, even though the politics, again, are really right on the surface, still, I can feel like a person in the world that doesn't have to be working all the time.
You've got this title called Work Won't Love You Back. Tell us when you got the idea to write the book. What's the gist of it?
Yeah, so perhaps shaped by my inability to get a real job for several years, when I did finally start journalism full time, I became a labor reporter. I write about work. I write about people's experiences of work, people's experience organizing at work, the different ways that work shapes our understanding of and political relationship to the world. And so this book comes out of obviously my experience, but also of what I was hearing over and over again from workers in a variety of different fields who do a variety of different things within those fields. And we're having this similar experience sort of everywhere, which is this ratcheted up expectation of sort of devotion to your job, of longer hours, more work, always on, always checking the cell phone, always checking the whatever, on-call shifts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that this was really happening everywhere. Everyone I talked to, nobody was saying, oh, my industry has gotten easier in recent years. I've been asked for fewer hours, unless it was people who have, you know, not enough hours at their part-time job, so they have two part-time jobs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, nobody was essentially saying that the trend was going the other way. And in so many of these industries, particularly ones that have been sort of defining for the way we talk about work in public in recent years. I'm thinking about teachers, obviously, because there have been several really big, important teacher strikes in the last 10 years, that those industries are being asked specifically to sort of do more with less by caring more, right? And we see this the way that teachers have been talked about in the pandemic, that like you can somehow overcome the fact that, you know, putting 40 kids in a classroom is going to spread COVID by just caring about the kids more. And that obviously is not true or realistic. And the way that that pressure has been placed on again, on so many of us, it comes from somewhere. It's different than the way we talked about work 50 years ago. And it is ratcheting up still. So that's the story that I wanted to tell in this book about how the way we think about work and its relationship to our lives and our happiness and love has changed.
So you have this title, Work Won't Love You Back. What do you mean when you say that? It's very provocative. So what is the sort of 30,000 foot view of what you're trying to say here?
Yeah, the 30,000 foot view is just basically that we work under capitalism, not because we are bored and need something to do with our time, but because if we don't have a roof over our heads. We don't have food to eat. We don't have a right to any of these things without working, right? So ultimately, when you go to a job, your boss, no matter how nice your boss is, and I've had some great ones that I'm still friends with, ultimately, your boss is trying to make money by paying you less than the value you produce for them. And so this command to love our jobs and do what you love and all of these, you know, various cliches that we've all heard a million times, they miss the fact that like work is not giving you anything remotely close to what you're giving to it. And that is just sort of a fact of life under capitalism. Again, no matter how nice your boss is and how much you, if you are the boss, are trying to be good to your employees, ultimately, you know, the choice is going to be about money at the end of the day.
So you can put a tremendous amount of emotional energy, intellectual acuity into work and truly love the work that you're doing. Mm-hmm. And your premise is work will not give you back. It will never be able to give you back what you give to it.
Right.
I'd like for you to go actually to page 26 of your book. Mm-hmm. We're going to read a few passages. You make a comment. Actually, starting on page 25, you say, love is women's work. Then you go to page 26 and then say, the labor of love begins then in the home. And if you can read that paragraph for us.
The labor of love begins then in the home. We are still told that the work of cleaning and cooking, of nursing wounds, of teaching children to walk and talk and read and reason, of soothing hurt feelings and smoothing over little crises comes naturally to women. These things are assumed not to be skills, not to be learned as other skills are through practice. And this assumption has crept from the home into the workplaces of millions of people, not all of them women, and has left them underpaid, overstretched, and devalued. Our willingness to accede that women's work is love and that love is its own reward, not to be sullied with money, creates profits for capital.
So one of the things that was really interesting to me as I read this is I thought to myself, I have many friends and colleagues who have chosen to work in the home. That is what they do.
Right.
And when I read this, I thought, this is so helpful because I look at them and I think on many levels, they are so much more competent than I am of their ability, their ability to run a household, to project manage, to cook and to can and to clean and to paint and to deal with children squabbling, all of these skills.
Right.
And so when I read this, I think, oh, that's part of what's happening is that we assume that those are not in fact skills.
Right.
They're things that people just do.
Exactly. Exactly. And like I'm, as I've noted, 41 years old, just learned how to cook last year in winter lockdown by myself because suddenly I had time. Suddenly I wasn't going out in the evenings and I wasn't going to order takeout every night. And so here we are learning to cook. And I just had literally never learned, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that these moments where you sort of realize like, oh, this isn't actually that hard. I just never learned it. I'm still terrible with a knife. It still takes me like 5 times longer to cut up vegetables than anybody else. But like, I learned this now and now I enjoy it because mm-hmm. I got better at it. I would not mm-hmm. at all say I'm good at it, but I got better at it. Mm-hmm. And it makes it much easier with, you know, the various ways of functioning in my life, especially, I mean, I've worked from home, my paid job from home, as well as the actual housework that goes into running a home mm-hmm. for 8-9 years now. And it's much easier to function in all of these ways when I also like cook myself a decent meal. You know, after we get off recording this, I'm going to go make myself like an actual lunch as opposed to a bowl of cereal or something. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's a skill set that I just didn't have. It certainly didn't come naturally to me because I am a woman. I also should mention that I'm terrible with children, which is also, again, a skill set I never learned because I never babysat as a kid because kids freak me out. They're very cute, though, and I like knitting other people's children baby gifts. But so
Note to everybody.
We don't think of these things as skills. And that means that we also sort of don't think of people who are staying at home with their children, for instance, as doing real work. And one of the points, I think this is in the book somewhere, but in any case, the economist Nancy Fulbray makes the point that if you have two women who have children and they stay home with their child every day, they don't get paid for that. But if they actually swap children, they can take a tax deduction for paying each other to watch their children, to do the exact same thing, right? If you have a two-year-old and I have a two-year-old and we swap two-year-olds, we're doing the same thing, but you can get remunerated for that. And that just shows you, right? It's the same exact work. It's just that sometimes it's paid and sometimes it's not.
Yeah. From a household standpoint, that is very important. And then you talk about how that gets pulled into the workplace.
Right.
So talk about that for just a moment.
Yeah. So I was just mentioning, right, people who get paid to take care of other people's children, which is the second chapter of the book. I profile a woman named Adela, who is a nanny, who, right, her job is to take care of other people's children. But it's also true in teaching, right? I already spoke about teaching a little bit, that we expect women to be teachers because women are naturally good with children and that they will care for the children. And as I was saying about the pandemic, right, that like, teachers will go back into the classroom even though the COVID risk is still there because they care about the kids and they're willing to put that before their own safety or the kids' safety, frankly, and the kids' family safety in the real case of bringing home COVID to a family member who might be more susceptible to the virus in a variety of ways. So we've seen this, don't you care? Don't you care? If the teachers cared, they would do X and Y. And, you know, there's no amount of caring that you can do that will make you not spread a virus, right? I had COVID. I could have cared very hard, but I still, the best act of caring I could do was stay in my house for 10 days until I was sure I wasn't going to give it to anyone. And that's also true in all of these other places. Like one of the things that fascinated me when I was writing this book, because I separated it into two sections. And the first section is based around caring work and these ideas of caring work in the home. And the second half is based around these ideas of art and creative work. But when I got to computer programmers and specifically video game programmers that I was talking to, so many of them were like, yeah, and our bosses, our workplace is a family. And one company even branded itself as a fampany. And it was so striking to me, right, that like even in this very masculinized industry, right, which is, again, artificial, the idea of the family and care is still going to be used to motivate these workers, you know, the vast majority of whom, particularly in video games, are young men.
So interesting. A quote that I want to read out loud that I think is very compelling before we go off the women in the home. It's page 53 for anybody who wants to go buy the book, which I hope you will. You say, you're quoting actually, I think it's Nola. You say, she says, the small scale stuff is where you actually build the biggest relationships with the people in your life. And they remember you when you're just cooking or just chatting or you're just doing the constant low level care. It's the thing that is making us human and the people that are teaching us to be human. This is so undervalued, but it's the most important thing in the world. Any thoughts on someone's listening and saying, okay, I get it, Sarah, and maybe this is just about raising awareness. Is there something else that people might want to think about doing beyond having a greater awareness?
Yeah. So that's a quote from Ray Malone, actually. Her daughter's name is Nola.
Got it.
And she's talking about her daughter in that moment. And yeah, so Ray is a brilliant, she's an artist, she's a theater creator, and she's also a mom. And she also organizes around motherhood in a variety of ways that are really, really interesting that I go into in great depth in the book. And so one of the things that she works on, right, is sort of bringing specifically single parents, a lot of the time specifically queer single parents, together to talk about what they need. And you know, one of the big things they need is money, right? So right here in the US, one of the things that's being fought over in this endless nightmare in Congress is the child tax credit, which for the first time under sort of Joe Biden's first big package as president, they made the tax credit fully refundable so people could actually get a check in the mail. I'm sure plenty of your listeners have had this experience, which is, right, it's a huge, huge shift in American public policy. And what it does is it acknowledges that we, you know, people like me who don't have children, but who pay taxes, still have an interest in making sure that other people's children are cared for. In England, where Ray lives, there is a mother's allowance that has been paid out for a long time, and it has not really gone up with, you know, inflation. I think it's 80 or 90 pounds a month, which is not very much money. But it is this recognition that, like, as a society, we all have a role in making sure kids are cared for. And that would be helpful, right? Again, not just in terms of putting concrete cash in people's pockets when they desperately need it, which is certainly true. If you look at the numbers of attrition in the workforce since the pandemic, a lot of it has been women. And a lot of that is because women are still tasked with most of the childcare. And without the schools being open physically or without, you know, other childcare arrangements being possible, suddenly all of this is falling back on women. And so we need money, certainly, but also, like, these are public policy questions about childcare, right? One of the big pressures to get the schools reopened is because there's no other option for where the kids can go so that the parents can go back to work.
Yeah.
And so all of these questions are things we really need to think about, not only in a world where, you know, we're probably going to have to deal with some form of COVID for a very long time, but also in a world where, you know, we just haven't treated these as public policy issues for quite a long time.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. I love this one quote. And again, I'm not sure who said it, but domestic workers who said, if domestic workers don't show up for work, then the majority of the workforce can't show up for their work. I love my work because it is the silk thread that holds society together, making all other work possible.
Yeah. So that is Adela Seely, who is the nanny that I spoke about. She's incredible. I spent a day with her in the home where she cares for these kids, and just like she's brilliant. And like, I got so lucky with, I mean, I went seeking out people like this, but I still feel like I got incredibly lucky with the people that I interviewed who had just like such sharp thoughts about their own work and their own role in the broader economy, right? Adela goes to work every day taking care of these kids. During the pandemic, for a while, she actually moved in with the family that she cares for, meaning her own kids were at home and her own kids are a bit older, so she doesn't need to supervise them quite as much as she did the baby that she, you know, is being paid to care for. But still, she ended up having to make a choice between being at home with her own children or being at work with the kids she's paid to care for so that those kids' parents can in turn do their work. And this is, again, related to what I was saying about the schools being open, right? That, like, We've privatized this problem so that people like Adela's employers who can afford to hire somebody like her to come in and take care of their kids, they have at least something to fall back on, right? So Adela moved in with them. They were able to keep doing their work knowing that there was somebody that they trusted caring for their kids every day. But for people who can't afford to pay a full-time person a full-time salary, where does that go? Where does that fall? And so, you know, these connections are not only about, you know, the work is sort of similar on its face and the experience of the work is similar, but it's actually literally all connected, right? It's like, who is going to care for the next generation so that we can continue the human race and continue to support those of us who, you know, are going to be old or sick or in other ways need care and not be able to do it for ourselves anymore? That question is so huge and so sort of under-discussed and under-debated. And we just sort of assume that it will be done at home in private by the family or that the family will come up with the money somehow to pay for it.
Sarah, what happened that this became so important to you?
It's weird because, right, I have never wanted children. As I said, I'm sort of terrified of them and don't really know what to do with a baby. I had a rash of friends had babies during the pandemic, and it's been a lot of like meeting babies and they're like, do you want to hold them? I'm like, no, I'll wave from over here. And I think because of that, I spent some time thinking about like, well, what is my relationship to childbearing, you know, and going from being like a snotty teenage punk who's like, oh, it's not my problem, you had a kid, to going, okay, like, yeah, I may not want to hold your baby, but I definitely want to pay taxes so that you can like have an easier time caring for your baby. And I think you also probably need a break from your baby because, oh my God, I would need a break from my baby if I had a baby. Because babies are just need monsters, right? They just need everything constantly taken because they can't do it themselves, which is, again, totally reasonable. But, you know, the idea that one or two people can provide all of that all the time is just, like, terrifying to me. And so on some level, I think that that like, thinking about it that way made me go, okay, yeah, so this needs to be a social problem, because this is just not a thing that, like, a small group of people can handle.
When I hear you talk about it, there's such passion and there's such a sense of almost mission around it. And I almost wonder if, because you don't have children, there allows you to have this inside-outside perspective and advocate and zoom out in a way that possibly someone who's in the thick of having a two-year-old cannot do. And so this is one of your ways of giving to the people that you care about.
I hope so. That sounds very nice. I think also, you know, I'm also drawing. Yeah, no, but I'm also, of course, drawing on a lot of the work that has been done by people who organized and fought and theorized while taking care of their own children. So, you know, I mentioned Ray, who I profile in that chapter, but also, you know, I talk about the welfare rights movement, which was a movement of women, mostly single mothers, mostly Black single mothers, who, you know, said, like, what we're doing is work. We're not expecting a handout from the government so we can sit around and eat bonbons. Like, taking care of kids is important work. And it's deserving of support. And we deserve to have a dignified life and not have the welfare department come, like, sifting through your underwear drawer to try to determine if there's a man in your life that should be paying child support. We deserve to have this taken seriously as important, socially necessary work. I don't want to say, like, I have a particular perspective by not having kids so much as I want to say, like, I've had the luxury of time because I don't have kids to spend a lot of time reading and writing and talking to people who are doing this work on top of, you know, all of the very exhausting work of being a parent.
You make another statement, and you've started to touch on this, but you talk about how the romantic attachment of the artist to the work is the counterpart of familial love women are supposed to have for caring work. I'm going to read another quote. You said, just as the assumptions about women's unpaid work spilled into teaching and retail, our ideas about artists have spilled into programmers, scholars, and even athletes. This has turned creativity from a basic human quality to a private preserve, enclosed behind the boundaries of its own world.
One of the things about art, and I'm sort of living in the world of the NFT now, which is just sort of puts an even finer point on all of this, is that the way we sort of fund art in the world that we live in now is through the sale of art as an asset, right? Mm-hmm. So you make a piece and you sell it and somebody buys it to hang on their wall, display in their house, put in a museum maybe if you are famous enough. That's how you get paid, right? Mm-hmm. Is if you become famous enough that somebody pays, you know, $5,000, $10,000, $5 million for your painting, then you get paid. Less all the gallerists and promoters and whatever who get a cut. And so, like, we are taught to think that, like, the asset economy, and this is where, like, the NFT comes in, right? As people sort of sell it, is like, oh, it's another way artists can make money for their art. And it's like, well, what if we actually thought that art was important and paid for it publicly because it, again, we want art to exist. Early in the pandemic, I talked to a worker from the Guggenheim Museum, you know, and they were all being laid off, furloughed, et cetera. And he was just saying, he's like, you know, when this is over, we're really going to want museums. We're really going to want the arts to help us make sense of what's been happening to us. And again, like, we don't think of these things as public preserves so much. And again, that's different elsewhere, right? In some places, museums are free or are pay what you want. And I think about I spend a lot of time in London these days where a lot of the museums are free. And you can just walk through, especially pre-COVID when you didn't have to get, like, timed entry, a lot of things. You could just sort of walk through the portrait gallery on your way somewhere, which I would just do because I could, because I was going to meet a friend. And, like, rather than walking a city block, I would just, like, duck through the museum and walk through. And then there's Crystal Castles, I think is what it's called, which is one of the Walton family. I'm forgetting her name now. Alice Walton, who owned Walmart, has a beautiful art museum in Arkansas. I went there when I was working on my first book and reporting on the Walmart shareholder meeting. And it is also free, but it is hers. And it is, in that way, it's a private tax shelter rather than a public resource for everyone. And yeah, you can go in and walk through it, and it's beautiful. I recommend, if you are in Bentonville, Arkansas, that you do. But that's different than it being a publicly available resource for all. Mm. Right? And so those dimensions, I do think they matter, right? Because Alice Walton at any time can sort of choose to close that down, take the art off the walls, put them in her private house, and tell us no more. Mm. And if it is public, then we have a right to it. Mm. And then the funding for it comes from somewhere else that actually has to be distributed with some sort of idea of equity.
So building on that, one of the places that my head is going is that by making this something that, again, people are either just born as artists or not, mm-hmm. or they're creative or not, right. we have stopped believing that everyone can be creative and believe that that is the domain of just a few.
Yeah, I wrote a little bit about this in the book, and I've actually been just finishing a book review on a biography of Vivian Mayer, who is a photographer and a nanny. And her photographs were sort of discovered after she had died, or actually they were discovered while she was still alive, but nobody knew who she mm-hmm. was. And then she mm-hmm. died, and that was how the person who had bought her photos at auction figured out who she was. She was a nanny her whole life. And people are sort of shocked and stunned that, oh my goodness, this nanny was actually this amazing photographer and had these storage units full of this incredible work that she really never showed anyone. And, you know, the sort of documentary about her and then the biography of her that I was reviewing sort of take this as this puzzle of what was wrong with her that she didn't show the art off. And I wind up sort of finishing the review on a different question, which is, what if we just believed that every nanny had a storage unit full of masterpieces in them? What if we believed that every person had a storage unit full of masterpieces in them? And that's actually the lesson of Vivian Mayer. Not that, like, oh my God, this poor woman who is so exceptional got trapped doing this low-paid care work, which, again, we were just talking about the need for respecting that low-paid care work, right? And paying it more. But actually, what if we believed that everybody had some art inside them that in most cases we don't get to do because we have to do the thing that pays the bills? And the thing that's sort of extraordinary about Vivian Mayer is, while she was doing the thing that she had to do to pay the bills, she also managed to amass this incredible portfolio of, you know, art that now famous artists think is so impressive.
Let's transition. I think what I'd like to do is look at some intersections between your thinking and my thinking and see, kind of rapid fire, give you an opportunity to respond and just see what comes up. So first question I'd like to ask you is, I have been talking about how it's not just the great resignation, but there's an element of this that's the great aspiration that people have, in some instances, are resigning from, but that implies a giving up because of the pandemic, because of the experiences that we've had. We have discovered that we want more, that we can have a better life than we've had. And so when we're resigning, we're actually aspiring to something different. What are your thoughts? How would you respond to that?
So I think in a lot of cases, it's true that people are resigning to move on to another job, right? What's going on right now is not people quitting jobs to give up work, largely because we can't. As noted, mm-hmm. people have to pay the bills. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, so what Rebecca Given, who's a labor scholar at Rutgers University, called it the great job shift mm-hmm. is what's going on. And that is not even necessarily, though, that aspirational so much as it's other than like the aspiration to get a little bit more money. So I spoke with a woman named Precious Cole, who is a member of the Fight for 15 in North Carolina. And she had been working at a different fast food restaurant and then got actually recruited by McDonald's, who was looking for people and offered her $15 an hour. So she took that job. And it's, you know, that this wasn't a moment of sort of quitting because of some grand aspiration to work at McDonald's, mm-hmm. right? It was just literally like, oh, I can get a better offer now because the mm-hmm. labor market is a little bit tighter. Mm-hmm. And so you can actually quit and move to a different job that may be very similar as you know, what she was doing mm-hmm. at these different fast food restaurants, but offers you a little bit more payment and a little bit more respect, right? Being recruited in, saying like, oh, we want you. We heard you're good. We need good people who are reliable, who are, you know, good at their jobs. that offers you at least a little bit more respect. You know, again, back to the service industry, because that's one of the places where the job market has been particularly rough. A lot of people during the pandemic got laid off and then decided, okay, this industry is broken. What are we going to do instead, right? What can we do now that will be maybe a little bit safer, right? I mean, line cooks were one of the positions most likely to get sick of COVID, most likely to die of COVID. So maybe we want to work in an industry that's less likely to kill us. I feel like aspiration might be like a bit too lofty, just as I think that people comparing the Great Resignation to a general strike are being way too lofty. But it is at bottom, it is people moving jobs because they think they can get a better job somewhere else. Whether that is like some grand moment to try to realize a dream, or whether it's simply, you know, moving across the street to the restaurant that pays you slightly better, that's, you know, a question that we need sort of better numbers on and better surveys on.
All right, next question. So I know this is going to be a complicated one. Within my faith tradition, we will say that the work of God is to bring about the eternal life of man, of individuals. And so it's interesting as I think about that notion of God's work is to help other people or help us be happy. What are your thoughts?
The way that we have valued things is deeply screwed up, right? And it's screwing us up, but it's also, you know, melting the planet. Again, living in New Orleans right now is sort of being at the end of the whatever of climate change, right? Of knowing that like this stuff is coming for us. The city is sinking. And
but you moved there anyway, Sarah.
I moved here anyway.
So there's an optimism there.
Knowing that it's not permanent, I think, is the optimal point that I would make there, is sort of knowing that this is a short-term decision because it's not permanent. But what do we actually place value on is it's such a big and messy and complicated question, but somehow, you know, we got to this point in the world and like the only people that this current system is making happy are like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, and they don't even seem that happy, honestly. We don't value care for each other or for the natural world. We value exploiting those things. What would it actually mean to look at the world and not to be sort of cliche about like, and we tried to measure what makes us happy because like gross national happiness as a metric is also kind of weird. And also because I'm working on another project about grief. And I actually have a poster hanging on my wall that I just bought while working on that, which is from, I'm Jewish, it's from that. And it's says, "Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. You are not obligated to complete the work, but neither of you are you free to abandon it." And I think that is very Jewish, but it's very particular to this idea that what is important for us to do as work, as people in the world, as sort of our, you know, again, the cliche of our rent for living on the planet, is to make it better, right? Is to solve that grief. But also grief is never going to go away, right? We can't solve death no matter how much Peter Thiel injects himself with virgin's blood or whatever it is he's doing. We are not going to solve death. It's going to be there. Grief is not going away, even if we make the world less miserable than it is now. And so, you know, in some ways, I think happiness can also become a commodity, right? Barbara Ehrenreich and Will Davies have both written excellent books about that, if you are so inclined, about the way happiness itself becomes this thing we're supposed to sort of buy and buy into. And happiness on the job is, again, part of this idea of the labor of love, is that you will be happy at your work. But none of us are happy at our work all the time. I really do love what I do. And also, I'm exhausted, stressed out, and want to tear my hair out a lot of the time. Happiness is often sort of too much to ask, but also a goal we should strive for. And I think the tension in there is sort of where we have to live.
In our work, we talk about the S-curve of learning, which is a model for you to think about what growth looks like, a very simple visual model. And as I'm thinking about your ideas, they can be very helpful. I'm going to tell you what I think, and then you can reflect back to me. When you're trying to make a decision of what to do next, I want to do X next, or I want to do Y next, I think that some of your insights around what we're valuing as a society versus not can be very helpful in our sorting through the decisions that we're making. For example, if someone really loves to care for children, but society does not value it, right, then you've got to say to yourself, okay, but I value it.
Right.
And I like doing it, and I'm right, good at it, and I want to get better at it. So I'm going to do it anyway, even mm-hmm, though I know that there are societal forces that are suggesting to me that in fact it is not valuable. And right, so your work, I think, is helpful in teasing through some of those decisions that are tough to make around what society is valuing versus not when it comes to work.
Yeah, I think, you know, every single day people are making those calculations and also making them in the other direction, right? I've been working on a story recently about teachers who are leaving the classroom, again, the great resignation context, right? Because the pressure of the last few years has just been too much. And these are teachers who, to the person, all say that they love being in the classroom and they want to be in the classroom. And if they could just be in the classroom and teach, they would stay. But that there are all of these other pressures on them that have made that choice impossible, or they have family members that they're worried about, that any number of reasons that the choice, the set of factors that you weigh in to make those choices, you know, they change, they shift mm-hmm, over the course of your life, right? You might be healthy right now and think like, okay, I can take the risk of being a classroom teacher during a pandemic. And then suddenly you get diagnosed with cancer and you are going to be on, you know,
right,
a regimen of medication that suppresses your immune system. And suddenly it's no longer safe,
yeah,
to risk getting COVID, or somebody in your family does, mm-hmm, right? And so these calculations will shift over and over and over again based on differences in circumstances and differences in just how you feel and relate to the world. The reason that I wanted to put all of these different stories together in one book is to say that, like, there also are, you know, political choices that we can make as a society to value this work differently, mm-hmm, to value this work that is incredibly important better, and value it monetarily, not just sort of by clapping for care workers or whatever it is, but actually really to say, you know, or not like billboards that say thank you, essential workers, but like a raise for essential workers. Mm-hmm. You know, more time off for people, paid sick time, which is a huge thing that still most people in this country don't have. That these are decisions that we can make not as an individual person trying to bargain them in your individual job, but like as a city, state, country, to make sure that everybody has mm, them, regardless of what mm, job they are in and how much they like it or don't like it.
One of the things that you talk about in your final chapter is that the side effect of all this love for work has been that talking about love between people has lost its importance. Any thoughts there?
Again, I wrote that chapter before the pandemic, and then I literally finished the book in February of 2020. Timing is everything. And then sort of went back and did a lot of reporting on it. And, you know, after 2 years and change of various kinds of lockdowns, I think that that's only just like more important to me, that the value that I place on being able to spend time with the people that I love is sort of more important than ever. And it's particularly, I think, important for those of us who don't live in a nuclear family structure, because the pandemic sort of put us in what I've been thinking of as little Margaret Thatcher units, because of the famous Margaret Thatcher statement that there is no such thing as society. There are individual men and women, and there are families. And if you live alone, it was really, really isolating. I mean, I learned to cook. That's great. But I was also just incredibly depressed for most of, you know, the 6 months of, you know, intense lockdown, because I was alone. And the way that I live my life, the support systems that I have, didn't sort of fit well into a COVID bubble. And that meant, you know, really thinking about like the way that people show up for me and the way that I show up for them, and how much I value that, how grateful I am to the people in my life who do love me, even in ways that Margaret Thatcher would not have recognized as important. In addition to shaking up people's relationships with jobs, I think we also have to really consider our relationships with each other and all of these different ways that we have those that are not just sort of parent-child, husband-wife, wife-wife, any other sort of, you know, now state-sanctioned couple form, family form. But like, what about all the other relationships? Because the people that I know that were, you know, locked down in a family were also losing it and missing their friends and needing something other than like their, you know, their partner and their baby, but also needing other contacts. Yeah, if anything, over the last few years, I've just like sort of sat with that one a lot more and thought a lot more about like what is it that we need as a society and a world to value all of those relationships that aren't so easily sort of commodified, the way that our world shrank when we weren't allowed access to the people that we love.
So your book became even more poignant as a consequence of the pandemic. So Sarah, what was useful to you in this conversation?
It's always interesting to see what people pull out of this book and the sort of the thoughts that, again, that you know, that Adela and Ray shared with me that were really resonant with you. I think that's so useful to me because especially, you know, with people, Ray, I still talk to regularly. I saw her a bunch when I was in London recently. So it's always great to be like, yeah, this ongoing sort of relationship that I have with this person is resonant for all the people who read this book who don't, you know, don't know anything about that, but just know that, you know, the things that she said about care and relationships, and again, during the pandemic, right, have been helpful to other people. I love that, you know, that people are drawing this out of the book, that I'm not just talking about like, yeah, you should work less. Yes, you should work less. But also, what is it we're giving up when we work all the time?
Any final thoughts?
It's a moment where we're being told that everything is over, go back to normal. And that is so very much not the case. And also that, like, you know, in the early days of the pandemic, when we were all absolutely terrified, I don't want to sort of romanticize that moment. But we also saw how quickly everything can change. We saw how quickly, you know, the government can send us all checks for $1,400 or whatever the first one was, that we can give homeless people housing, that we can think about our relationship to work and which work is essential and which work we can actually kind of do without. That all of those things are now being sort of shoved back down the memory hole and we're being told to just get back to normal. And normal was killing us before COVID. So I want to sort of remember that space of change and possibility and think about like how we can do it in a place when we're not all terrified of dying of COVID. And like, you know, to be fair, like a lot of people still are. I had COVID, you know, a month ago. It's not gone, right? And that's part of it. But also like, the new normal has to be different than the old one because the old one was just broken in 1,000 ways.
Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I have 3 big takeaways from my conversation with Sarah. Number 1, we need to value the right work. I do not want to diminish the power of work itself. Work done well and work that builds on your innate talents in service of people you care about, that can be enormously fulfilling. I felt it, and I know you have too. But Sarah's point is so important. Not everyone can access that feeling equally because our society values some work more than others. Some people are born for a certain S-curve. They're amazing at it. They love doing it and they get immense satisfaction, but there's no money in it. Sarah is imagining a world where we can all be compensated for what we do well if we will shift our social priorities. Number 2, is it a great resignation or a great aspiration? Well, I prefer the latter. Sarah says the picture is more complicated and the truth is still unknown. How many people have quit their jobs to pursue a lifelong dream? And how many quit to work the same job down the street for a bit more money? After all, the labor market is in their favor right now. And what will become of those who pursue their dreams but never make a living at it? As Sarah says, we need more data. But if we've truly learned from the pandemic and aspire to broaden our scope of what is valuable, maybe we can empower some of those aspirational people to stick with it, and then they'll succeed. Number 3, don't let work become your counterfeit family. I dislike this trend as much as Sarah does, and I'm glad she's shedding light on it. It is wonderful to value your colleagues or boss. Shared experience forms deep friendships, but don't confuse employment with family ties. It's simply wrong and won't work out well for you in the end. For more on burnout, purpose, and work-life fit, listen to Jennifer Moss, episode 238, Tanya Dalton, episode 241, and Callie Yost, episode 155. Thank you again to Sarah Jaffe for joining us. Thank you for listening. Thank you to our producer, Matt Silverman, audio engineer and editor, Whitney Jobe, and production assistant, Stephanie Brummel. I'm Whitney Johnson, and this is Disrupt Yourself. Disruption.